The Caribbean is our major focus this week. Hurricane Melissa hit Jamaica, Cuba, and Barbados. And meanwhile, the storm clouds of war gather over Venezuela. War in Sudan is also a major feature in this week's news. A major city fell after an 18-month siege. And now we could be about to witness another genocide. Some are predicting that the war in Ukraine is drawing to a close. So we're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. We've got two major events happening in the Caribbean. We've got the hurricane, and we've got President Trump, who's been destroying drug shipments and moving major naval assets into the area around Venezuela. Is he planning for war? Well, we're joined by our Anglo-America correspondent, Andrew Miller, to get a picture of what is going on.
Yeah, that's all really important points. The Caribbean's definitely an area we should be very concerned about. It's often described as America's soft underbelly, just due to the fact that, just looking at the geography of the world, America's protected by the world's two largest oceans. On its east side and its west side, as major mountain chains, the Appalachians and the Rockies on its east side and its west side. Up north of it is Canada, which they've had good relationships for years, and the Arctic tundra. So really, most potential threats to the United States come from the south, through the Caribbean, through the Gulf of Mexico. So a very important area to keep an eye on for what's happening there. The hurricane season this year has actually been a little tame compared to some other years, but we finally did get a very big one in the form of Hurricane Melissa. Came in there and hit Puerto Rico and some surrounding islands. I think the death toll is up to around 40 people now, last I checked. Probably still rising. And then, of course, just tremendous amounts of damage through the area that is going to be rising up insurance rates and really just being another humanitarian and economic curse on the United States. Then at the same time, we have a major military buildup. This has been ongoing, where President Trump has deployed, I believe we're up to about 10,000 troops now, 8 ships, drones, a nuclear submarine. So not just a few troops, a major military buildup that Congress actually has not approved. And the justification is that they're fighting drug trafficking. Venezuela's kind of a unique case in Latin American drug trafficking in that their major cartel in Venezuela, the Cartel of the Suns, is directly run by the Maduro regime. So it's not like Mexico where there are these bloody turf wars between the government and the cartels. In Venezuela, the government is the cartel. And so to take down the Cartel of the Suns, you actually have to take down the Venezuelan government. And so Trump's probably, in order to maybe get congressional authorization to make this last a little longer, saying that he's very concerned about drug trafficking in the United States. He's moving troops, 10,000 troops, along the borders with Venezuela and a major troop buildup. Those, I don't believe any of the planes or ships so far have actually gone into official Venezuelan waters or Venezuelan airspace. Although Trump has openly mused that if the drug trafficking doesn't get better, he may approve ground strikes in Venezuela. And then has also given the Central Intelligence Agency permission to start looking at operations on the ground in Venezuela, which has led many people to believe, probably justifiably, that Donald Trump's real goal is toppling the Maduro regime.
Now, you had an article on our website this week talking about this, talking about the possibility of Donald Trump coming in there, taking out Maduro. No one here is going to be mourning Maduro if that happens. But you also made the case that there's another power that could be the biggest beneficiary, and even that might be Donald Trump's partner in this endeavor.
Yeah, any discussion about regime change in Venezuela logistically has to involve the Roman Catholic Church. Catholicism is the dominant religion in Venezuela, and right now, pretty much the only people who can openly speak against Maduro and not get thrown in jail for it are Catholic cardinals. Because the Maduro regime is a totalitarian state, most opposition candidates who rise up against Maduro end up getting killed or imprisoned. The Catholic hierarchy has emerged as the main opposition force to Maduro, sheerly by virtue of the fact that they are so popular that the Maduro regime, they do persecute them and they do take measures against them, but he kind of has to walk on eggshells, and that being too, coming across like he's too anti-Catholic could sign his own death warrant in terms of like just prompting uprisings against the Catholic Church. So interesting thing is, as the troop buildup has gotten big and Maduro's gotten increasingly concerned that Donald Trump might start ground invasions in Venezuela, he wrote to Pope Leo to mediate the situation and prevent war. I don't think Pope Leo's publicly responded to that request yet, but he did go ahead with something he's been planning for a while, and canonized the first two Venezuelan saints in Roman Catholic history. The beatification process, that's the process of making a saint, takes a long time in the Vatican, but they finally got around to approving 19 people for beatification, two of which are Venezuelans, which just happened to be the first two Venezuelans ever made saints in history. So the Maduro regime was initially pretty excited about that, kind of viewed it as a sign of papal favor on Venezuela, until they saw a lot of the outpouring of support, particularly for Cardinal Porros, who's been an outspoken critic of communism and the Maduro regime. And so very quickly, the Venezuelan government, they canceled a big mass that was supposed to celebrate these canonizations. They told Cardinal Porros that he couldn't travel to these celebrations, so that he wouldn't be there where all the people are celebrating. They've even tried to, because the Venezuelans are so excited about these two saints, claim that Cardinal Porros was the one trying to stop the beatification process, and that it was really Maduro who made it happen, which is, maybe in a place with state-controlled media that lie will get a little traction, but it's, like I said, Pope Leo, despite being born and raised in Chicago, has spent most of his clerical career in Peru. I think he's pretty close friends with Cardinal Porros. I haven't seen any signs of a rift between Leo or Porros, or the fact that Porros didn't want these canonizations to go in place. So it really does just seem kind of like a really poorly thought out scheme on Maduro's part to make it look like he's responsible for this thing the people are really happy about, instead of the Catholic Church, because he knows that you get too much zeal for Cardinal Porros and the Catholic Church, who's a critic of his regime. The Venezuelan Bishops' Conference is the most likely power broker in determining what would replace the Maduro regime. And so even though this beatification process has obviously been in play for a while, I think the fact that Pope Leo went ahead with it and decided to announce it now as opposed to next year or the year after, right at this time when the tensions between Maduro and the Bishops' Conference are high and Donald Trump is surrounding Venezuela with military forces, is probably not a coincidence. I think that both Donald Trump and Pope Leo and the Catholic Bishops' Conference in Venezuela would like to see Maduro go. They want regime change. They probably don't want Iraqi-style regime change, where you just go in there and kind of ham-fistedly topple an autocrat with no plan for what comes after, and that just descends into chaos. So they seem to probably be going about this pretty deliberately in a way to make sure that you've got some pro-Vatican politician who's going to emerge from the chaos. But I drew the comparison in the article about just the fact that Ronald Reagan and John Paul II kind of did a similar coordinated strategy in bringing down the Soviet Union. Ronald Reagan imposed sanctions. Ronald Reagan did an arms buildup. The Soviet Union's battered economy was having a hard time keeping up with that arms buildup. Then the Vatican brought in the first Polish pope in Catholic history, who really stirred up Polish nationalism, support for Catholicism in Poland. And so then when Poland, with Catholic support, broke away from the Soviet Union didn't have the power to crack down on it because of Ronald Reagan's arms buildup and sanctions, and the whole thing just fell apart. And so, but it definitely took both of them, both the Pope and the President, to pull off that geopolitical maneuver. And so if Donald Trump and Pope Leo are kind of, they kind of seem to be, whether it's coincidence or not, probably not, pulling off a similar maneuver where Donald Trump's ramping up the sanctions, ramping up the arms buildup, while Pope Leo is making some saints and really just trying to stir up a lot of Catholic patriotism for Cardinal Poros against Maduro. And we'll see. I've predicted the fall of the socialist regime in Venezuela many, many times over the past decade. And have been wrong all those times up to date. But I wouldn't be surprised within a year or so if you, if Trump and the Pope actually have some success in getting a more pro-Western, pro-Catholic person running Venezuela, which would be prophetically significant. If you read chapter 7, I believe.
Right. Well, actually, that's what I wanted to get into, because I think your point about Europe is a really nice point of comparison, because Herbert W. Armstrong forecasts that. Like, he forecasts the Catholic Church working and playing a major role in Eastern Europe, breaking out from behind the Iron Curtain. So in 1951, for example, he said, it is prophesied, or he wrote, sorry, in The Plain Truth, it is prophesied some of these Balkan nations are yet to throw off the Soviet yoke and realign themselves with the Pope. And he said that, there is a possibility of an internal political coup brought about by an underground Catholic influence, which can restore their ties to Rome. He said, do not underrate or sell short Catholic power, strategy, and resourcefulness. And, he said even many times, much more specifically, that, he said, communist oppression in Eastern Europe is being overthrown. We've shown years in advance what would happen to Russia's ill-fated empire in Eastern Europe. He forecast this breaking away. 1957, when the right psychological moment arrives, a number of these Eastern European nations will break away from Moscow. And so he said they'd break away, and he said that the Catholic Church would have a major role in that because of very clear Bible prophecies about the rise of a Catholic Holy Roman Empire that includes nations from Eastern Europe and Western Europe. And so, for that to happen, you had to have nations break away from the atheist Soviet Union and return to the Catholic fold. That's been fulfilled. And you have other prophecies that inform our forecasts of exactly the same thing happening now in Latin America, which I think you were about to get into.
Yeah, I think one of the best resources we have for that is actually chapter 7 of our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury's booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision. You wouldn't normally think a book called Isaiah's End Time Vision is going to have a bunch of information about Latin America, but this chapter 7, it's titled Building Towards a World Catastrophe, and it focuses in on some prophecies, especially in Isaiah 23, about this economic mart of nations led by Tyre against the nations of Israel. And he points out there that anciently, Tyre was the primary trading center in the Mediterranean Sea, and actually, once the Assyrians conquered Phoenicia, was actually the primary Assyrian trading center in the Mediterranean Sea. And so applying this to modern day, this is about a revived Assyrio-Babylonian empire in Europe dominating world trade and using its domination of world trade to besiege the United States. And so now just taking this prophecy about a European besiegement of the United States, and then you look at a globe of where Europe is and where the United States is, and so much of our trade is with Latin America, that just geographically for Europe to besiege the United States, it needs influence, to the east of the United States and to the west of the United States and to the south of the United States. And so this prophecy, it's really going to have to be like a European-Chinese alliance that also involves Latin America. And the book Isaiah's End Time Vision points out that the plain truth under the late Herbert W. Armstrong pointed often to the fact that Europe, it's going to need Latin America to besiege the United States, and it has two really powerful ways to get influence over Latin America. One is the fact that the Latin American nations all speak Spanish, except for Brazil, which speaks Portuguese. But Spain, being a member of the European Union, like Spain is kind of the bridge that connects Europe and Latin America. But then also the Catholic Church is Europe and South America are the two Catholic majority. That's where most of the world's Catholics live. Latin America is definitely a Catholic majority region. Europe might not be anymore. They've got so much secularism in there, but it's still the most popular religion in Europe. Of religious people, Catholicism is the dominant religion in Europe. But the Spanish language and the religion, it really gives Europe power over Latin America. And that book, Isaiah's End Time Vision, points out that unlike Poland and these eastern satellites Mr. Armstrong talked about as actually joining in a group of 10 kings under an empire in Europe, the Latin America-Europe partnership isn't going to be a union of equals. The Latin American countries are going to be vassal states to Europe. And so I'm not saying it's completely impossible that as the Catholic Church rises to power, Maduro won't see which way the wind is blowing and become a vassal to Europe. But given his history with very extreme versions of socialism, extreme versions of communism, his alliance with Russia, his alliance with Iran, and some of these more radical forces, it seems like one of the more likely ways for this prophecy about Latin America becoming vassals to Europe to be fulfilled is for Maduro to go in a more pro-European, pro-Catholic supporter, as most of Maduro's opposition candidates are, take power in Venezuela. And that definitely makes Donald Trump's moves in synchronization to what the Pope's doing in the region pretty significant.
Well, thank you for that very clear rundown. Isaiah's End Time Vision, great place to dig into more detail on that prophecy. And then also, of course, there's He Was Right, that has a fair bit to say about what Mr. Armstrong said about Eastern Europe, but also recaps a good deal of what he said about Latin America, and even how we've seen a lot of that proven true as America's influence in that region has just absolutely collapsed. Well, you're covering the whole kind of Anglo-America, English-speaking world. Andrew, what other stories did you want to bring our attention to quickly?
Yeah, just another couple quick stories. We've already talked about Hurricane Melissa. So one thing I helped write up for the morning brief this morning, just before coming into the studio, is some new revelations on Operation Arctic Frost. That's what they're calling this scandal that happened during Joe Biden's presidency, where the FBI was basically subpoenaing financial records and seizing phone metadata from prominent Republican lawmakers in its attempt to prove that Donald Trump tried to unlawfully overturn the results of the 2020 election. And so one person on the Senate called this 100 times worse than Watergate, yet you're still not hearing about it because of the corruption in media. And it is because, like, Watergate, for those who remember that, have read about that, was the Nixon administration seizing some office files from just a few high-profile Democrats, where this is the Biden's FBI subpoenaing and subpoenaing 197 organizations and seizing phone metadata from like 400 and something Republicans, people who they had no proof had committed a crime. So it's definitely not a innocent till you're proven guilty thing, but just seizing this records, looking for anything these people may have said or done to be misconstrued into trying to overturn an election. So big revelations on the corruption of the Biden administration there. We've also got more information on just how addicted America is to debt, in that the government shutdown is ongoing. Democrats refuse to pass a spending bill until Republicans agree to increase the spending for Medicare and Medicaid. And this is actually bringing us to what could be a pretty big crisis. Is I checked this morning, and the food stamp program, about 41 million Americans rely on food stamps, is set to run out of money tomorrow, on Saturday. So if they don't come to a conclusion to this within the next 24 hours, you're going to have people on food stamps who are no longer getting these food stamps. And I'm sure they'll come up with some sort of compromise that's going to get us even more into debt in order to prevent the food stamp people from going without food stamps for too long. But it does just cast a spotlight on how bad America's ultimate bankruptcy is going to be. And that, like, you can't keep spending like this forever. Eventually, you will go bankrupt, and you're going to have 41 million very angry people in the streets because they've been reliant on government food aid and things. They may not get messy this time, but definitely getting messy in the future.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a look at the consequences of what happens when America does run out of cash. It's been amazing to me to see. You know, I'm sure that there are people that genuinely need help and that the food stamps are perhaps even a literal lifesaver for. But there's a lot of people that are kind of have such an entitled mindset of, you know, the food stamps, this is my money. If the government's not going to give me my stuff, I'm going to go out there and I'm just going to steal. I'm going to take it myself. This has led to a lot of then people kind of looking at the background of some of those posting this and showing, like, okay, well, as a taxpayer, I'm paying for your groceries, but you're doing this thing that I can't afford and this thing and this thing. And I think it both is leading to a buildup of hatred and animosity on both sides. But also you can see how when America runs out of money for that program, how quickly everything could explode. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens when that program expires. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. Talking about starvation, talking about war, I think that brings us to another tragic news story this week, and that is Sudan, where we've had the conclusion of an 18-month-long siege, and it looks like that could have some terrible consequences. So to hear more about this, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, so on Sunday, the Rapid Support Forces, one of the factions in Sudan's civil war, conquered finally the city of El Fasher, also spelled Al-Fashir, in the Darfur region. This was the last stronghold of the Sudanese government in the Darfur region. So now basically the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF, this rebel faction, now control the entirety of Sudan's Darfur. If this is for any of our older listeners bringing up images from 20 years ago of the crisis there, that's not a coincidence. The RSF, they're the successors or rebranding of the Janjaweed, these Arabic militias that under the former dictator regime from back then basically killed thousands and thousands and thousands of people in the Darfur in a genocidal campaign that was highly publicized but never really settled, brought to trial, brought justice. The Darfur that's in the southwestern corner of Sudan, that's mainly populated by Black Africans, sub-Saharan Africans, if you will, many of whom are not Muslim, but Sudan is a majority Arab country. And the genocidal campaign back then was to basically ethnically cleanse Sudan from these non-Arab populations. And there's a big worry that the RSF are going to do the same thing of what they did 20 years ago. And we're already seeing signs of that early on.
And this is a story where we've got satellite images from space showing the mass killings, reports from hospitals of mass slaughter. It's a tragic story. It's a story that exposes a lot of hypocrisy in the West. I mean, where are all of the genocide activists that we've seen all over our streets about, you know, the fake genocide that's been going on in Gaza, the accusations of genocide for Israel? Here we've got a much bigger humanitarian crisis and a real one, and they're all silent. And in this case, there are the RSF, they're not dropping leaflets warning where their attacks are coming. They're not opening up humanitarian corridors so that civilians can flee. They're not doing anything whatsoever to facilitate aid coming in. And in fact, the exact opposite. They're trying to drive people away from aid stations. They want people to die of starvation here. And also, this is a genocide, an ethnic cleansing, a war crime that the West is complicit in. And again, you get people say, like, trying to call for an arms embargo on Israel and accusing the West of helping Israel. Europe helped fund and train the RSF. There are very credible accusations that the European Union did this because they wanted the RSF to stop migrants coming into Europe. So they are they killing people now with guns bought by money handed to them from the European Union? And are we seeing border guards, quote unquote, armed border guards trained by the European Union that are these soldiers doing the murdering? And then these same European leaders will turn around and get on their high horse and say that Donald Trump is evil and immoral because he wants to build a wall with Mexico. And it's like, you know, you took people that, and like you said, Simon, like this is the Janjaweed militia. These are people that committed genocide in the past. So this is not a surprise to find these people committing genocide, ethnic cleansing, war crimes. It's not a surprise to see them doing that again. So they took known war criminals and funded and armed them to try and stop their migrant crisis. And they have the gall to say, well, building a wall is wrong. Or to blow up this footage of border guards using whips, and that all got kind of became a big fiasco out of context. So it's a it does expose a lot of hypocrisy. But did you want to put what's going on in Sudan in just kind of the wider context of what we're watching in the Middle East?
Even compared to other war zones, like, just the scale on like how well documented this is and just how atrocious this is, I think is at the very, very least, very underreported. And perhaps, like you mentioned, even deliberately so. You mentioned those satellites from images from space. What images are we talking about? We're literally seeing the sands of the Sahara from space stained red from all the blood that's been spilt in this city. That's literally, you could see the blood stains from space. That's how big they are. This city, El Fasher, that we're talking about, there's approximately 200,060 people that live there. about half of those are children. That 18-month siege that you were talking about, that was a deliberate blockade of those people to starve them to death. And now the man-made famine is over, and now people are going to kill. You could go on social media and see videos. You could play some B-roll footage of this right now, of the Janjaweed openly documenting their crimes and putting them up for people to see. They look very similar to what Hamas did on October 7th, when you're seeing people basically rounded up and shot on with the camera rolling via firing squad of people literally getting run over by cars. And you could see the wheels crushing people's chests. This is the kind of atrocities these guys are committing. And as you said, they've been sponsored by the West. There's even more blatant sponsorship from countries like the United Arab Emirates. They are very overtly funding this group, sending them weapons right now as the war is going on. It's very well documented. I don't see crowds going around the Emirati embassies calling to boycott them. I don't see like trade embargoes putting on the United Arab Emirates. You still, like a lot of these Gulf states, we talk about them on this program, you still look at them and you see the shiny buildings and you think, oh, what a nice modern place it is. How integrated they are into the Western world order. This is the kind of stuff they're sponsoring right now. And like, as you mentioned, as I mentioned, this has been going on for decades. People keep talking about how Gaza has been an open-air prison for who knows how long, that this is an ongoing genocide for decades and decades. This is an ongoing genocide in Sudan right now, going on for decades and decades. Very well documented. And like you said, where are the protesters? Where are the people that care about the Darfuris right now? They don't. But anyway, to tie this into broader Bible prophecy, the main prophecy that we look to in this part of the world is Daniel 11 verse 40 and the next verses after that, which talk about an end time clash between Europe and a king of the south, which Trumpet editor-in-chief Mr. Gerald Fleury has identified as being Iran and radical Islam led by Iran. Iran has a lot of influence in this part of the world. It's sponsoring the Houthis in Yemen at the southern end of the Red Sea, and obviously, it sponsors Hamas, too, at the northern end of the Red Sea. And Mr. Fleury, based on how the scriptures read, it mentions countries like Libya, Ethiopia, Egypt being aligned with the king of the south. That hasn't happened yet. But because of that, Mr. Fleury sees Iran's strategy as controlling this vital corridor connecting the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea. And that is one of the pushes, the prods that gets Europe involved in this region. As you mentioned, Europe already has a lot of tentacles in Sudan. Iran has a lot of influence with the Sudanese government. It's a little bit more complex there. They also have relations with the United States and with Israel. Where Sudan specifically falls into this camp, we're not completely sure. But either way, it is still a very volatile region that is literally being fought as a proxy war right now, and we expect this whole Red Sea, North Africa region just to get more and more important as the days go on. And if I could recommend one piece of literature for people to look at, it'd be our trends article on the Trumpet website about why the Trumpet watches a clash between Europe and Iran that goes into this trend in a bit of a broader perspective on what we expect for this region.
Thank you very much for that, Mihailo. Did you have any other bits of news from the Middle East to bring us?
Yes, just one. Speaking also about Iran, yesterday CNN reported that China has been clandestinely selling Iran ingredients for ballistic missile fuel since at least September, or at least that's when the shipments have been arriving. This is violating the recent snapback sanctions that the UN imposed at the behest of Germany, France, and the UK, at the behest of Europe. So China has been helping Iran rebuild basically a banned weapons program, which if you rewind 6 months ago when Israel and America were bombing Iran's nuclear sites, there was a lot of speculation that, oh, this means the end of the Iranian regime. Their weapons program is finished. The government has lost all credibility. They are not going to recover from this. Just a few months later, you're already seeing them recover at least to a degree a lot faster than probably a lot of people expected, and it's being done by the help of foreign actors, and the UN sanctions aren't really doing anything about it at this point. Nobody really wants to stand up to China at this issue. It reminded me of, during our August print issue, Mr. Joel Hilliker, our managing editor, had an article called "Is Iran's Regime Finished?" that goes into what a lot of people were speculating and what the Bible says, what we just talked about right now with the King of the South, with Iran. We still expect Iran to be king. And you're seeing them catch up a lot faster than probably a lot of people would have hoped.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. We've also had some pretty tragic news out of Russia this week, as Russia has made more gains in Ukraine and perhaps a very significant breakthrough. To get the latest on this, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. We are on day 1,346 of Vladimir Putin's three-day war, and reports from Ukraine say that Russia now has amassed more than 11,000 troops near the Ukrainian city of Pokrovsk. And there are even some reports saying some of the Russians are now inside parts of the city. And this is potentially very significant because Pokrovsk is a place of deep strategic importance. It is a hub for railways and roads as well, including several that the Ukrainian military has heavily depended on for resupply of soldiers and weaponry. So it's just a vital node for logistics. So if the Ukrainians lose control of the area, it would have implications far beyond just this city. And for that reason, the Russians have been pushing hard to capture this city for about a year and a half now. For a year and a half, they've been grinding toward it, and the advance had been terribly slow and agonizing. They have lost tens of thousands of soldiers in the process of pushing toward Pokrovsk just to get to the outskirts of the city. But now it does look like that may be paying off and that they may be on the brink of capturing it. There was a report this week from Eurointelligence, and it said that, quote, "There is more confirmation now that the Russians have entered the city and that the two sides are fighting in the city itself." And then this report goes on to detail just what a momentous win this would be for the Russians if they're able to capture it. It would position them to be able to quickly push toward the cities of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk. It could also position Russian forces to be able to encircle at least part of what is usually called Ukraine's fortress belt in the Donbass region. That's a line of Ukraine-held cities and towns that the Ukrainians have been heavily fortifying for years now. And this fortress belt, it is considered Ukraine's last major solid defensive line. Once you get past this, it would be pretty much wide open onto the capital city and even further west. So the implications of a Russian encirclement of the fortress belt are very far-reaching. One other part of this Eurointelligence report says, "We will probably only know with the benefit of hindsight whether this was really the moment that turned the tide of the war, but it is the most significant development along the front lines to happen in years." So there's a lot to keep on watching there, but the truth is, whether or not Russia soon captures Pokrovsk, we should expect it to either win the war or at least not badly lose the war. And this is because of what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said about Russian President Vladimir Putin's role in biblical prophecy. Prophecy shows that Putin will emerge from this conflict still as a strong man and that he'll go on to fight in much larger wars in the future. One of the main passages that you could study to see that is in the book of Ezekiel, chapters 38 and 39 especially. And we have a free booklet that puts those chapters under the magnifying glass, taking a very close look at them, word by word for some verses. And it looks at related passages as well to explain what Putin's role will be in the final world war. And so from this, we can infer that he's not going anywhere for now. And this booklet is called The Prophesied Prince of Russia by Mr. Fleury, and it's a booklet that we send out for free to anyone who would like a copy. So I hope that you will visit thetrumpet.com or check out the show notes for today's episode of Trumpet World and order your free copy of The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. I mean, I think it's, to me, this looks like a really interesting time for the war in Ukraine, that it feels like a very make or break moment. Like, I'm on the one hand, we're seeing these headlines about the breakthroughs that Russia is making. On the other, I've seen more and more headlines about the pressure Vladimir Putin is under. And I think a lot of those headlines are driven by wishful thinking, because we've seen these throughout the war. You know, kind of like, so many people in the West would love for this war to end with Putin's regime broken and him out of office. And understandably so. But because of that, I think we do tend to overreact a lot of in the West to struggles for Vladimir Putin. And he has proven much more resilient than some of these same people that are now saying, well, he's under a lot of pressure, thought many years ago or many months ago. But with these new sanctions from President Trump that look like they might actually have some bite, and we are seeing, it's a nuanced picture. We're seeing parts of India and China say now we're still buying things from Russia. We're also seeing, especially India, some saying, okay, well, because of these sanctions, we're not going to risk buying this particular type of Russian oil from these particular companies. But you look at the latest inflation figures coming from Russia, it does feel like you're reaching some kind of point where they can't sustain this for too much longer. And it feels like, well, is this the all-out push? Like, do or die, we're going to kind of go out and break through and wrap it all up, because if this keeps dragging on, we're starting to reach an exhaustion point.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I believe the picture is quite nuanced. And I think that, you know, you're correct that a lot of that Western optimism is hyperbolic in a lot of ways, and probably a little bit ill-founded. But it is true that just about every metric economically that we're seeing come out of Russia does paint quite a bleak view of their economic health. And it does seem like these sanctions are beginning to really bite. And then what makes them so much more destructive to Russia is the fact that Ukraine is coupling these sanctions with what they sometimes jokingly refer to as sanctions of their own, which is sending drones to blow up Russian oil refineries and other energy processing infrastructure. So you've got, from some reports, it sounds like as much as 20 or 25% of Russian refining capacity and other processing of their oil may be offline right now because of those Ukrainian attacks against their energy. So when you have that coupled with these sanctions, it is beginning to dry up the main source of funding for the war. That doesn't mean that, you know, the demise of Putin is imminent, but it does show that the pressure is building.
And that's where I think if I was watching this without Bible prophecy, I'd be kind of saying, well, maybe it could go either way. That we might see Putin fail imminently, or we might see him succeed totally in Ukraine imminently. And this is where, well, you know, we're expecting this guy, Vladimir Putin, to fulfill this prophesied role of the Prince of Russia, to lead this Asian alliance. And so we expect him to stick around and certainly, like you say, not lose catastrophically with what is happening in Ukraine, and very likely win the war and get a lot of, or maybe, I don't know, we'll see whether it's all, whether it's a lot of, how much territory he ends up taking, but certainly expanding his kind of neo-Soviet empire. There were other stories, though, some other significant prophetic stories from Asia this week. Did you want to update us on those as well?
Sure, yes. One of them you actually briefly mentioned there, or actually the only other story I wanted to talk about, is just a quick update on those sanctions that we spoke about last week that U.S. President Donald Trump put on Russian oil. President Trump, of course, is trying to dry up Russia's funding for the war so that it forces Putin to the negotiating table and brings about a ceasefire. So he imposed these sanctions last week, along with European powers as well. And the notable thing about those new sanctions is that they include a mechanism to punish organizations in other countries that do business with Russia's two main oil firms. So that, of course, mostly means China and India. And when we spoke about this last week, I mentioned that early reports showed that the Chinese and Indians were backing away from Russian oil because they were just too afraid of being blocked out of U.S. capital markets because of these sanctions. But this week, though, we are already seeing China and India apparently sticking with Russia, at least in part, despite the sanctions and the threat that they carry. So India's largest oil refiner is called Indian Oil Corp, and they came out on Wednesday saying that they will not stop buying Russian oil. Now, it does look like they'll be shifting to non-sanctioned Russian suppliers. So they found, I guess you could call that a bit of a loophole. But then on the same day, a report came out showing that one of China's major refineries, called Shandong Yulong Petrochemical, has actually increased its purchases of Russian crude since the sanctions were imposed. And in the case of this Chinese refinery, there's no indication that they're trying to shift to non-sanctioned Russian suppliers or find any other loophole. They seem to just be saying, you know what, America? Go ahead and sanction us. Block us out of your capital markets. We don't care. So we do see some economic lines being drawn here and some shifts underway. And this is all a huge part of the reason why Putin is able to keep on pushing toward Pokrovsk and how he's able to afford to keep paying his soldiers and keep them equipped with weaponry. So it does show that there's quite a lot of solidarity between the giants of Asia. And that's just what the Trump has been warning readers and listeners to expect for many years based on biblical prophecy.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Well, before we go, I'll give a quick rundown of some of the significant news from Europe this week. We had yet another pretty inconclusive election this week in Europe. This time it was the turn of the Netherlands. They now seem to be heading for a four-way left-right coalition. They held the vote on Wednesday, and the anti-migrant PVV party of Geert Wilders lost 11 seats. They are incredibly close to the D66 party in terms of who's going to come in first place. At the moment, with well above 99% of the votes counted, D66 are in first place, but it's still too close to call. But even so, that loss of 11 seats for Geert Wilders and his anti-migrant and anti-EU party is a fairly major defeat for him. I mean, historically, it's still pretty good. He's still a force to be reckoned with, but he seems set to be out of any future coalition. A lot of these other parties don't want to work with him. Instead, it looks like D66 will lead and that the Netherlands will get their first homosexual prime minister. The D66, they're kind of a pro-EU, pro-environmentalist liberal party. They did change their tune for this election on migration to try and pick up people that are concerned about migration. I don't necessarily believe that they will do much on that front, but they at least shifted their rhetoric. They will likely go in coalition with, we don't know for sure yet, but you've got the VVD. They were once the main right-wing party. Think, say, the equivalent of the Conservatives in England, or think maybe like Never Trump Republicans. Gives you a fairly good flavor for what they're like. Also in this potential coalition is the GL/PVDA. I'm just kind of giving the acronyms because most of the time they stand for stuff in Dutch anyway. But GL is the Green Left. PVDA is a kind of the Dutch labor movement. So maybe think the Democrats. And then also with a party called the Christian Democratic Appeal, a center-right Christian party. And this is not a stable coalition with all of this going on. They would have a strong majority without the controversial Geert Wilders. It's probably going to take them less than the 6 months it took them last time to get a government together. But don't expect strong, decisive leadership coming out of this coalition in the Netherlands. So more of this leadership sickness that we've got in Europe. It's there in France where we're having government after government fall. Spain is having all kinds of difficulties. Now, for Spain, with their constitution, you can't vote out the prime minister until you've got a coalition in place to take his place. That's about the only thing keeping them in power there. I mean, it's so many of these different countries now where they cannot form a stable government and they've been stuck for years now. And this is going to lead to the rise of a strong leader that isn't going to come to power through the democratic process, isn't going to use democracy. And he is going to come from Germany. It's weakening France. It's weakening the Netherlands. The fact that they've got all of these different crises. I mean, Germany, yeah, it means that they're weak right now. But economically, they're in a much stronger position than France. The amount of money that they've borrowed is tiny compared to what France is borrowed. So it's not like they have these kind of big movements undermining them while they lack that strong leadership. But keep watching for that. That is a critical forecast that we come back to again and again, that you're going to have the rise of a strong leader in Germany. And we have our booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, that gives you a lot more information on that, help you prove from the Bible why we're expecting this strong leader and why he plays such an important, such a dramatic, such a decisive role in Bible prophecy. So you can read that booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. Also this week, The Telegraph had an article where they spoke to some top officials in the British Army, where they talked about Britain should share nuclear bombs with Germany. The former NATO Secretary General Lord Robertson, he said, "I welcome it. It's right and proper that we're having this discussion about sharing nuclear weapons. It should have happened a long time ago." You had Field Marshal Lord Houghton. He said, "The infilling of a European option other than France has to be something that's on our mind. We need to be talking about this." But Lord Houghton has some reservations. He said, "Is this a good thing or is it madness?" And if something, the great military minds aren't sure of its madness, maybe we should be a lot more cautious about this than we're being. So Britain has already agreed to work with France on its nuclear program. Now we're looking at, and these leaders are saying, we need to have a serious conversation about working with Germany. And America has already given Germany nuclear bombs. America sold Germany stealth fighters to carry these nuclear bombs. Now Britain is looking, and France are looking at sharing nuclear bombs with Germany. We have an article in our September Trumpet print called Aiding the Enemy that goes through the way that Britain and France are actively helping Germany rise as this massive military power. So you could go and read that if you want more on that important story. This one kind of shocked me this week. This wasn't something that was massively on my radar, but a senior judge in Belgium warned that Belgium is becoming a narco state. Belgium is becoming Venezuela or Mexico in Europe. She said, "We are facing an organized threat that is undermining our institutions. Extensive mafia structures have taken a hold, becoming a parallel force that challenges not only the police, but also the judiciary." She said, "An attack with a bomb or weapon of war, a home invasion or a kidnapping are all easily ordered online. You don't even have to go to the dark web. A Snapchat account is all it takes. Moreover, it's not even expensive. Often a few hundred euros is enough." Now, I don't think she made this connection, but I think you can quite clearly see the connection to Europe's migration crisis. This is just one of the social problems that this has caused. So many, when you've got these terrorist attacks been happening in France, so many of the people behind those have come from the suburbs of Brussels. And this is a big part of the reason why people feel unsafe. So you've got this going on in Belgium. You've got grenade attacks and gang problems in Sweden. All of this coming because of mass migration. So Europe is killing themselves through this, and it's killing democracy through this. I mean, this is part of the reason why the Dutch elections are stuck and all of these other countries are stuck. The mainstream parties have just they're so wedded to this idea of mass migration, and they've tried to make it against international treaties or against constitutional law to do anything to stop it. And yet it's reaching crisis proportions to the point that understandably people will do anything to stop these crises that hitting their countries. And the only way they can do that kind of at this point is to bring down the established order. And that's going to lead to the rise of this German strongman. So keep watching that story. Similarly, on this subject of immigration, this is such a dumb story from Britain that came up on Friday while we were recording the show. So here in the UK, we have had a series of a long-running protest movement outside migrant hotels. People don't want migrants being housed in these hotels in their communities. And there was a lot of unhappiness with this for a long time, but the thing that kicked off the protest movement was an Ethiopian immigrant who raped a 14-year-old girl. Now, he was finally sentenced. He was due to be deported. And then this same guy that kicked off this nationwide protest movement, the government released him by mistake on Friday and gave him £76 instead of deporting him. And so you had this panicked manhunt over 3 days where they were trying to track this guy down. So, I mean, the Bible, Hosea 7 verses 9 to 11 talks about Britain being a silly dove in the context of migration and foreign policy. It's an absolutely massive silly dove story. It's hard to think of a sillier series of events there. So that has been a pretty massive deal for Britain. And then a final important story, tragic story really for Britain coming today, is that Prince Andrew is not Prince Andrew anymore. He has been quite thoroughly booted out of the royal family. He's a commoner. He is being completely removed from the roles of peerage. He had already given up his title of Duke, but he's being removed from the roles of peerage. He's just going to be Mr. Mountbatten Windsor now. No more prince. He's leaving his home in the Royal Lodge in Windsor. The king is going to try and keep him out of trouble by putting him up in a much smaller property over in Norfolk, a good distance outside of London and the spotlight. I've read a fair bit of British history. I can't think of a precedent. I can't sit here and say, well, we've not seen something like this since 1793 or 1582. I don't know where this has happened before. There've been enemies of the royal house, but normally they're still allowed. If you have even a civil war or falling out in the royal family, they're normally still allowed to keep the title prince. I think it's a measure of the disgrace that I was going to say Prince Andrew, but Mr. Mountbatten Windsor. It's a measure of his disgrace and the crisis of Britain's royal family. Mr. Flurry wrote this a couple of years ago. Britain has lost faith in its God and king and abandoned its moral foundation. The Church of England has surrendered its moral authority, loosening its standards on every issue: women in the clergy, premarital sex, homosexuality. The monarchy, rather than working to prevent the moral slide and uphold godly standards, has watched it happen and even encouraged it. And we saw that this week as well, where King Charles was at the opening of a memorial to homosexuals that were pushed out of the British army. It's a new sculpture at the National Memorial Arboretum. And it's there to commemorate those that were pushed out of the military as part of the homosexual ban. And you know, I think we all know what the righteous kings in Israel did to homosexuals in the Bible. And just banning them from the military is very minor. And those righteous authority in the Bible dealt with them a lot more severely than that. But the king is now apologizing for that and opening this memorial. He's encouraging this moral slide, and that's directly connected to all of these moral scandals that you see the royal family in. This quote goes on to say, Mr. Flurry wrote, "The royal family, including the new king, has been caught up in terrible moral scandals. British society suffered immeasurably as a result." I mean, you look at the king's life, and he's a divorcee, he's married to a divorcee. They have helped push Britain's moral slide. And it's very sad to see the royal family being used that way. This is a family God wanted to be a light to the world. To shine a light, to bring people to him. And he has a lot to say about the corruption in that family and what has been happening there. He has an article, "The Queen's Funeral Shows the Power of the Throne." And we have that on our website. We can put that in a link to the show notes as well. So, I mean, a lot of sobering news stories this week, a lot of pretty tragic news stories this week. So I wanted to end, though, on a bit more of a positive note. I wanted to end with just a clip from Herbert W. Armstrong and his Well Tomorrow radio broadcast. This isn't a clip I had to search particularly hard to find. Mr. Armstrong had these kind of clips all the time. It's the context that he would always put Bible prophecy in, and it's an important context that we need to remember. So this is just an introduction to one of his Well Tomorrow radio shows.
Well, greetings, friends. This is Herbert W. Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. And once again, I do mean good news, because we are going to have utopia, believe it or not. We're going to have a millennium. We're going to have world peace. But a great many hard-headed, practical scientists today who know what is being developed and know the trend of modern science and technology and invention are telling us that only one thing can bring world peace, and that is world government. Now, as I was saying in the preceding program, it's impossible for men to bring it about. Jesus Christ said that we would bring ourselves to such a place that if God did not step in and intervene, unless there is a supernatural God, a supernatural power, who is looking down on this world, and who is about to intervene and save us from ourselves, then I say to you, my friends, human life would be blasted off of this planet. Now that's precisely what Jesus Christ said, but he said that for the elect's sake, God is going to intervene and save us from committing mass suicide of the entire human race. But on the other hand, Jesus Christ came with a gospel, and that gospel was the good news of the world tomorrow. It was good news. It was not of this world. It was of the end of this world.
So what we're seeing is the end of this world, the end of this present evil world. And as Mr. Armstrong said there, this is Jesus Christ bringing us to the point that if God didn't step in to intervene, well, we'd destroy ourselves. And it's bringing us to the point where mankind, where we realize our ways don't work. We can't solve this planet. We can't bring peace. We don't know how to order our societies and our families. And so the mankind turns to God and says, teach me, show me. We're going to build a new society. Or God, you're going to build a new society. We're going to do it your way. That's where all this is leading. And it's leading to a wonderful, wonderful world tomorrow, as Mr. Armstrong called his broadcast. We have another booklet. I'll mention one more and a positive one to conclude on. The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like by Mr. Armstrong, that presents this beautiful picture. It shows you from the Bible the world that is coming very soon to this earth. That's where all of these world events are leading. So you can read that on our website as well, and you can order your own free print copy. Thank you to all of our panelists. Thank you to George Haddad, Matthew Threason, and Jason Hessong for their help in producing and recording today's show. And I think Daniel DeSanto helping as Mihailo Zeka gets set up over in our Canadian office. We'll have a special report actually from Mihailo on our Wednesday show on his travels around Europe and some on-location filming in the Netherlands and The Hague, catching you up on a lot of the accusations going on there against Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu. So watch for that on Wednesday. And until then, keep watching your world.